Let's go through every single package installed on a Linux install DVD, specifically Slackware 14.2. Of course, these are all open source packages that I'm talking about on this show, so they probably can still apply to you even if you're not running Slackware and even if you're not running Linux. These are open source packages, so you can download the source code and run them on any computer, whether you're running Linux, Mac, Windows, BSD, doesn't matter. You can learn probably something from this episode. So let's get started. Slackware 15.0 is out. I know I said that last week, but I'm saying it again because I was told on Mastodon by HackerDefo that I was actually pretty confusing about sort of what I was talking about when I was saying, here's how you can get Slackware. And so I want to set that record a little bit clearer now by explaining very explicitly your options were you to attempt to try Slackware today. So if you go to slackware.com, in the left-hand column, there is a link called Get Slack. That is the download link, or I should say, that gets you on the download track. So I'm going to click Get Slack, and now I'm taken to a subsection of the Slackware site called slackware.com/get-slack. This page introduces you to the concept of mirrors, which are, as the name implies, sort of mirror versions of servers that host a specific set of files. It tells you on this page to download the complete Slackware distribution from one of our mirrors. You can click on the word mirrors to be taken to the mirror site, which is mirrors.slackware.com. Okay, almost there. Now that we're here, you can look on, again, in a different left column. This has changed because you're on a different site now. And look for the link, the second one from the top, called Slackware ISO Images. Click on that link, and you're taken to a mirror. This is good. This has the files that you need. So on this mirror, you see a list of all the Slackware ISO, all the Slackware editions that this mirror happens to hold. This one goes back to 12.0. Not interested in that. 15.0 is what we're looking for. There are two editions of Slackware. There's Slackware and there's Slackware 64. So assuming you want the 64-bit edition, assuming your computer can run a 64-bit operating system, that's the one that you would choose. So I'm going to go into the Slackware 64-15.0 folder, and in that folder, there is a Slackware 64-15.0-install-dvd.iso. It is 3.5 gigabytes. That's the file that you would download for this task. Downloading that file gets you essentially a virtual DVD. It's a big file on your computer. I've been told recently by some people that on, I believe it's either Windows 10 or 11, that it automatically tries to sort of mount that virtual DVD as if though it was a real DVD. And it appears that it actually doesn't even download the data initially. It sort of downloads a file list or something. I'm not really sure. I wasn't there. I've just been told. It can be rather confusing. So I think probably what I would do is I would right-click on that ISO file and select Save Link As, and that kind of usually gets your computer, get your browser to just treat it as a binary blob and just download that, or an archive, download that, save it to your computer, and with no further interaction, which is generally what you want. I've not had that problem myself, so I'm just kind of reporting what I've heard. Once you have the ISO file, you can do two things, and this is where I was really, really unclear in the previous episode. You can either burn that ISO, actually you can do three things. You can burn that ISO to a physical disk. That's what I chose to do because, frankly, if I do anything else, I lose track of it. But if it's a physical disk, I can put it in a case on my bookshelf and it's always there when I need it. And I always find myself needing it for something. So that's what I do. Next release, I probably won't do that because I won't have any more disks left. Maybe I'll have a thumb drive that is dedicated to the task of being the Slackware thumb drive. Anyway, you can burn it to a disk using K3B or Bracero or whatever disk burning software you use. You can also, instead, byte for byte copy that ISO file to a thumb drive. Now, you have to do this in a very special and specific way. You cannot just drag the ISO file to a thumb drive. That will not work. I mean, it will do something, but it is not the thing that you want to do. You need to create a bootable thumb drive. Even if you have tried, and Black Kernel was talking to me on Mastodon about this, even if you've tried to do this with Slackware 64-Current within the last couple of months, try this anyway. Try this thing instead. DDIF equals the path to your ISO. OF equals the path to your thumb drive. BS equals 2M, maybe. And then, what is it? Status equals progress. That copies, and you have to do that as root. That writes out, bit for bit, the contents of that ISO onto your thumb drive. And now that thumb drive is bootable. You could take that thumb drive out of your computer, put it into another computer, or reboot your current computer, and boot off of that thumb drive. You'll get a grub menu, and you can choose which kernel to boot, and then you're in the Slackware installer, as if though it was booting off of a DVD. I know this because I've tested it myself. Reinstalled Slackware 15.0 to my NVMe hard drive from a thumb drive, and it worked exactly as one would expect. You can do that. It's very easy. Now, so that's the end. That's all I had to say, really. For maximum clarity, that's it. We're done. Except we're never done. What I will also say here is that the Slackware installer is quite flexible. It's really a small little script, and it doesn't care so much about the specifics. So there are lots of variations here that you could use if you had to. And that's kind of what I was talking about in the previous episode. You can get a little boot image, the USB boot image from the pxe-and-usb-installers directory in the source tree of Slackware. You could get that and make yourself a little boot image that's basically just the bare minimum required to boot a Linux system plus the install script. Now, it's only about 60 megabytes, I think, is what we said last time. Maybe smaller, I don't know. I don't remember, but I guess I could look real quick. I'm going to go here to ftp.osuosl.org/pub/slackware/slackware64-, well, that's 14.2, so I could go 15.0 instead. Here's USB and PXE installers, usbboot.img, oh, 60 megabytes, yes, I was correct. And then there's a USB image to disk.sh, 16 kilobytes. You could use that to just boot your computer, and then you step through the setup process, and eventually it asks you, hey, where do you want me to get packages from? And then you can point that to somewhere on the internet, or you could point it to a hard drive if you've downloaded all the packages for Slackware onto a hard drive, or if you've downloaded the ISO image and then mounted it and took all the packages out and put it somewhere. So there's a lot of flexibility with that. It's an advanced process, and it's not something you probably need to know if you don't need to know, but if you're really struggling to get something installed for some reason, that's another option. And then, of course, the other option that, for whatever reason, is highlighted on Slackware.com is Live Slack. And for that, you can just go to, well, like I say, it's highlighted on Slackware.com. It's kind of hard to miss if you read the release notes, which, again, is why I was so surprised that they didn't mention that the USB or that the ISO is a hybrid ISO, is what the term is, I think. I saw Hacker Defo use that. So it's download.liveslack.org, and that's Live Slack without a C, so liveslak.org. Download.liveslack.org would bring you to the live edition of Slackware designed by Alien Bob, and then you can boot off of that thumb drive. And once again, it's got an installer, and you can point it at the packages that you want to install, and you can go through that process. That's it. That's the process of installing Slackware in all the different ways that I can personally think of off the top of my head right now. There are yet other ways. If you go to, for instance, ZenWalk Linux, you could get ZenWalk and download ZenWalk, which is a smaller sort of edition of Slackware. You could install that and then switch over your mirrors to Slackware later and adjust. You could do the same approximate process with, I think it's Salix OS. It's based on Slackware, It doesn't look like they've updated to me yet to 15.0, so that isn't really an option yet, but presumably they will eventually. And the final, honestly, last one that I can think of, the final way to do it is to use Slack PKG. If you're running 14.2 already, not everyone knows that you can do this and have been able to do it with Slackware for ages, you can just upgrade your entire distribution from a running distribution. You do a Slack PKG update, Slack PKG install-new, and then Slack PKG space upgrade-all, Slack PKG space clean-system. And I have done it before. Actually, I don't know that I've done it from a release to a release. I have definitely done it from a release to current, which, I mean, that's the same thing. It just doesn't have the fancy number at the end. Okay, so that's everything. That's Slackware 15.0 announcement version 2.0. I think it's a lot better than the first one. I got very distracted in the first one about sort of what I had done. This time, I feel like I was a little bit more focused. So far, I have installed Slackware 15.0 from an optical disk and from a thumb drive, both from the same ISO file. And both were successful, so give it a try. Now let's dive in to the packages of Slackware. And this time we're going to pick it back up, I think, with Bomber. B-O-M-B-E-R. There's a couple of games in today's list, actually. I thought for a moment maybe I should just... Oh, it's not Bomber, it's Blinken. I thought for a moment that maybe I should just do KDE games or something. But, you know, I'll never remember that I've done it. Or I will remember, but I'll miss a game or something. I don't know. So I'm gonna stay the course. And the course is continue to go through the package list in alphabetical order. So that's what we're doing. I am going to launch Blinken. That's B-L-I-N-K-E-N. From its description file, from the .txt file in the package listing, it says that it is a memory enhancement game for KDE. When this game launches, you are greeted with an interface of four quadrants. There's a top left yellow, top right red, bottom left blue, bottom right green. This is a familiar game to me. I've seen this. It's like a children's game in the U.S. that you very frequently see in cheap toy stores and things like that. I don't remember what it was called. Something like maybe, I don't know, memory four, memorize, I don't know. Anyway, I'm going to click start, and now it tells me to choose a level, so I'll just choose level one because I'm not actually very good at this game. Okay, so it has just blinked the green selection, and so I'm going to click green, and now it's going to do green something. I think it's green blue. Yes, that was green blue. And now it did green, blue, yellow. And so on. It does this until you mess up, pretty much. I'm actually doing a lot better right now than I've ever done before. The problem for me is that it's actually a little bit boring. The lights aren't quite as pronounced as I think I would prefer. I think if I could go in and change the source code... Oh wait, I can. It's open source. So, yeah, you could look at this game and change things if you wanted. I mean, it's not, you'd have to recompile it and so on. So it isn't, it's not like a Python game where you could just kind of go in and just hack on it without really sort of thinking about your build chain and stuff. But I think it could be a really good game. And this goes for, well, honestly, for several of the KDE games. I think it could be a really great code base to look at if you're just starting out with coding. Or if you're, you know, sort of leveling up with coding, or very significantly, if you've been coding but you've only been using sort of the default widgets of a tool set, the games are really good to kind of get the feel and the literal code of what you need in order to design your own widgets for within a window. So that's quite useful. Blinken is a little bit on the boring side, I think. I mean, it's not my style of game necessarily. It might be very entertaining for some people, though. That might be a fun challenge. I mean, it's a very valid challenge. You know, it's just not, it just happens to not be a thing that I enjoy. The, there's a game that coming up here called Bovo, which I find a lot of fun. So, Blinken is just one of the many choices that you have, and You can try it out, see if you like it, see if that sort of thing is exciting to you. I do love that it is both visual and auditory. I think that's a really, really strong point of it. I think I kind of wish that at the beginning it played each light with the sound so that you could choose to just go off of auditory input rather than visual. And ultimately, the interface is only visual, as far as I know. Maybe that's not correct. I wonder if I could find that out really quick. Let's look at Blinken again. There is... Oh, these are high scores. I thought it was a configuration menu. It's not. Oh, but the question mark at the bottom is a rollover thing and gives you a bunch of new options if you roll over it. And it says handbook, settings, about, and about. Okay, so I'm going to go to settings. It asks me to choose the sound, to put the sounds on or off, and to put the font, to do a stylized font or not. I'm going to turn the stylized font off. I'm going to keep the sound on. But yeah, I don't see any way to just make it a... Oh, accessibility options. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4. Cool. Okay, so top left is 1. Top right is 2. Bottom left is 3. Bottom right is 4. So that means that I should be able to... Of course, I don't know how do you restart? All right, let me really quick... Let me look at this thing again. It says it's a retro electronic memory game from the 70s to KDE. That's exactly the thing that I was thinking of. I still don't know the name of it, but yeah, it's good that they referenced it, just because I wasn't really sure. Let's see. No, I don't see a way to... I don't know how to start the thing without... Oh, there we go. Oh, this is great. Oh, apparently not so great. Yeah, so you can play the game with control 1, 2. Oh, that's where I went wrong. I went 1, 3. I should have gone 1, 4, 3. Oh well. Anyway, you can play the game with control 1, 2, control 2, control 3, and control 4. Those are the quadrants. You just have to remember which quadrant each one is. Oh, yeah, I keep messing it up, but that's really cool. That's really neat. It would be nice if they'd mapped the quadrants to maybe the numpad or something so that it makes sense. Well, it's funny because I want it to make sense visually, but the theory is that this would be played without the visibility. Anyway, that's cool. That's really neat. I think that could be a really cool, just as an audio game, you know, because you don't see that many audio games, really. You don't get that many audio games, really. So that's kind of neat. Anyway, let's move on to the next one called Blue Devil. Do a var log packages on Blue Devil. This is the Bluetooth stack for KDE. And what a champion the maintainers of this stack must be. Because really, I mean, Bluetooth is it's a protocol that's been around since I don't know how long, something like 25 years or something. It was, I think, introduced in the late 80s or early 90s. And it must be the late 90s, early 2000s. Let's look. Bluetooth invented. 1994. Okay. So early 90s. And it's just, for me, in my opinion, it's just, it really seems like a pretty dismal little protocol, and I think that the best way to mitigate how bad Bluetooth is, well, the best way to mitigate it would be, I think, for someone to come up with something better. And I don't know what that is, so I'm not the person to come up with something better. So the fact that it exists, you know, I mean, I guess it's better than not existing. I mean, I certainly do appreciate that my Bluetooth, my little Bluetooth headset thing gives me the ability to listen to podcasts while I'm, you know, doing things around the house or outside while I'm, like, mowing the grass or something. I can listen to podcasts, and I don't have wires hanging all over me. So I do appreciate that about Bluetooth. I just find that Bluetooth is very slow, and it seems to be very clunky. It doesn't work reliably. It often seems to, like, sort of just lose its connection randomly. It just, I don't know. I don't like it. I do not enjoy using Bluetooth. I enjoy what it provides me when it works, but I don't enjoy really the protocol. But Blue Devil is the thing that brings Bluetooth into KDE integration and is much appreciated. It's an important stack, and it does, I guess, the best it can do with a really poor protocol. And again, the protocol, I'm sure it's very difficult to make these things because I can't do it. I don't enjoy it. But I do enjoy Blue Devil because it makes it all possible. So there's a bunch of libraries. There's Qt5 library libbluetoothplugin.so. There are some desktop files. Where's the other libraries? I thought there were more libraries. Oh, there they are. So there's things like kcm_bluedeviladapters.so, kcm_bluedevildevices, bluedevilglobal, and so on. There are two executable binary packages or applications in this package as well. One is called bluedevilsyndfile, and one is called bluedevilwizard. Now, those are handy to have, especially if you're not running KDE as your desktop. If you're running Fluxbox or something, but you just happen to be using all the K apps, which I sometimes do on a laptop, I'll think, well, why run the whole KDE stack? I don't feel like I need that. I'll just do Fluxbox, but I love KDE apps, so I'll use those. So those make it really simple to set up to pair a Bluetooth device with your computer. You can do Blue Devil Wizard. It's a very simple application. It's a one window application with a big window, a big panel where it scans for devices that it can pair with. You select that device and then you click next. It sends the device a request. The device sends something back. I think it's usually a PIN number, and then you type in the PIN or something like that, or you confirm the PIN. And then the two devices are paired, and that's it. Similarly, once something is paired, you can do a Blue Devil send file wizard. It's Blue Devil send file, and this shows all of the paired devices. You select the one that you want to send a file to, and then you click the little directory icon in the lower right corner to select the files you want to send, and then you click send files, and it sends the file over to the device. In theory, it is as simple as that. And that those are just the almost demo level applications. You come upon Blue Devil integration elsewhere though. So if you go to, for instance, system settings, or if you just type in Bluetooth, you're likely to come across things that are using Blue Devil libraries. So the Bluetooth configuration screen in system settings is pretty similar to the demo application. It's a little bit different, but you can pair devices through the little plus sign, and that literally brings up Bluetooth Device Wizard, which is exactly the thing that you get when you launch Blue Devil Wizard. I don't know where the send file is. It's probably, well, let's see, if I select this device and then click send file, I'll bet that brings up. No, actually it doesn't. But anyway, it's using all the Blue Devil libraries, so that level of integration is nice. But wait, there's more. You can also go to, for instance, I'll just go to my home directory in Dolphin. I'll find any random file. Here's a little tiny file. Right click, and in the context menu of Dolphin, there's a selection, send via Bluetooth. And if I roll over that, it brings up a list of all the devices, all the one devices that I have paired to my computer as a destination for files. And I could click on that, and it would send that file to that device and save it to that device to whatever default download location I had set. The device would already have to be paired with your computer for it to show up. You don't get to just send files to whatever device you like. But that is really nice because you don't need an extra application just to send a file. If that's what you're doing, you can just right-click on it in Dolphin and send it to the thing. So smooth, so easy. It's just right there. That's the kind of integration that I'm talking about with KDE, and it's an integration that you do not get in other desktops, much less in other operating systems. So really very cool. It's just such a pity about the Bluetooth thing. Well, let's go get a cup of coffee, and then we'll come back and we'll continue talking about the other B packages in the KDE software series. We'll take some listener feedback. I'll see you after the break. Okay, we're back. I've got coffee, and I'm gonna just keep going on the assumption that you also have coffee. So, Blue Devil was what we left off with. The next one is Bomber. B-O-M-B-E-R. And this, it took me a while to figure out how to play this game. This one seems to be a little bit off on the alignments for me, for the background. I'm not sure why. But it says, welcome to Bomber. Click to start a game. So I'll click. And now, I can't tell if I'm playing this. I am. Okay. So you can click or you can press spacebar to drop a bomb from this plane, which you have no control over. It's just flying from left to right, left to right, left to right. And it leaves one side of the screen and it pops up onto the other side of the screen. And I guess the goal of this game is to, you have to bomb, your plane is getting lower and lower on the screen, and you are meant to decimate these structures at the bottom of the screen before your plane reaches the bottom of the screen. That's how you advance to the next, I guess, level. And it gets a little bit tricky once you've started. You know, at first it's quite easy because you just can drop bombs and you can't not hit something. You'll always hit something because there's just so many things there. But then after a while you start to it starts to become more complex because there are fewer targets for you to hit, so you actually have to time your bombs. And there is a lesson of sort of the delay that it takes for a bomb to leave the plane and the time that it takes to reach the target. And so you do sort of start to optimize how you are dropping bombs, and you try to get better at it. I'm actually doing all right this round, but the plane just, it keeps getting lower. I don't know why the pilot is doing that. I just reached level 3. So that's what you do. And then and at some point, the buildings become variable heights as well, so now there are more optimal targets than others. And there's a little bit of an action economy, because as you drop a bomb, there's a little bit of a delay before the next one becomes ready. And so you really only have, like, maybe on a good run, you have 3 bombs before you get to the other side of the screen. So, yeah, it's a pretty fun little game. Not at first, I don't think. I think when I first played it, I'm on level 4 now. When I first played it, it took me a while to figure out what I was even supposed to do. I'd never seen anything like this before. And then the delay in the bomb dropping really kind of gets on my nerves, because it's just so frustrating. You just think, why aren't we dropping more bombs? But if you start to kind of just recognize the elements, the pieces that you have to play with, then you start to see the strategy of what you're doing. I mean, you just have to prioritize the higher buildings, or else you crash into them eventually. So that's Bomber. Again, I'll bet it's a great game to look at if you want to learn more about programming at all, but also just programming with custom widgets or programming games. I mean, it's a very basic, you know, side-scrolly type of game, but I mean, it's a fun diversion, and I think it's worth playing a couple of times at least, and it's probably worth looking at the source code. One more game, and then we're out of the B section, and then I'll switch over to some listener feedback. But this one is called Bovo, B-O-V-O. It's all of the games are really nicely done with vector graphics. So you can expand the game as large as you want, full screen, and it'll be just as sharp as at a smaller resolution, or window size rather. So that's kind of, well, it's very nice. So Bovo is also, it says in the About Bovo, I think it said that, maybe not. Anyway, it's a 5-in-a-row game, or it's sometimes called Connect 5, or what was the other name? It was a Japanese game. There are other names for this, but if you've ever played a game that has that wants you to connect 5 elements together before your opponent does, then you've played this game. It's like a really, really big game of tic-tac-toe, or noughts and crosses, as some people call it. So I'm going to click new, and it looks like the computer started for me, so, or started this game. So I'm going to start somewhere, and the computer started again, or has gone now. Of course, now there are problems because the computer has gone first, and I haven't played defensively, and so the computer just won. So I guess this time I get to go first, which is nice. This game is this computer is quite aggressive, like really aggressive. Puts me on the defense no matter what. I don't know how to get it to not be. Oh, it still won. Wow, computers are smart. Well, they're not smart, but they certainly know what their goal is. So that is five in a row, or Bovo. And you can change the theme. That's kind of cool. Oh, Gomoku. G-O-M-O-K-U. Gomoku. Gomoku. That's the other game. And that gives you a very nice sort of bold, deep red board with white tokens and black tokens that compete. Apparently, yeah, on what do you call them? On the intersections of that's actually a little bit busy. This is a little bit busy in my view. That's the tokens are a little bit large for that theme, I think. There's a high contrast theme, there's a spacey theme. I really like the scribble theme though. That was the default for me anyway. And it's just kind of handwritten X's and O's on a nice white sort of background with a blue grid. So Bovo is a lot of fun, and you can actually play it, I guess, with two players. I've not actually tried that yet, but apparently you can. Where does one configure that, I wonder? Because it did say two players, but I don't actually know how to turn the computer off and let. Yeah, it might just be referring to the second player as the computer, because I don't see anything for a second human player. Okay, so there's lots of different levels of difficulty as well. There's ridiculously easy, very easy, easy, medium, hard, very hard, extremely hard, impossible. It seems to be default set sort of in the middle. So I've just done very easy. I'll bet I still lose. Oh no, I see. Okay. Wow, the computer just makes really silly choices on very easy, or on ridiculously easy. Well, at least I won once though. Yeah, so that's a challenging game, and really nice too. I mean, that would be an interesting one to look at the code for, just to see the AI process, because it's tough. I know it's not really AI, but you know, to see how they implement that second player logic, that would be interesting to see, because it's legitimately a difficult thing to do. We don't think about it that often, but trying to get a computer to play at all, other than just randomly, against a player, for instance, in chess or checkers or something like that, you know, kind of that grid setup, such as Bovo, it becomes this sort of huge brute force process of just analyzing every single possible move and processing it accordingly, and that's hard to code. So that would be really kind of interesting to see, especially, and I am curious too, how do they implement those like seven different levels of difficulty? That seems exciting. How do you get it to, how do you dumb it down, or how do you make it more aggressive? I don't know. I'd have to look at the code. It is open source. As I've always already mentioned at the top of the episode, HackerDefo and Black Kernel were talking to me on Mastodon, helping me figure out what exactly is going on with the USB images of Slackware 15.0. I learned some new things and got clarity on other things, and I got a lot of really useful sort of back and forth from that conversation. So I'm not going to read that, but just know that that happened, and that informed the first segment of this particular episode that you're listening to right now. I also got an email. This one is from W4JED. He says, I don't know exactly when Slackware came to the US, but Slackware 2.3 was on the July-August 1995 Yggdrasil 5 disk setup that I did my first install from. And yes, I still have the box set. He makes a comment about, well, where to begin? Okay, I'll just read the rest of his email. He says, yes, it's when you found out how flap awful 3.5-inch floppies are, and Windows refused to mark the bad sectors on them, so your only choice was to throw brand new floppies away. So this is, Klaatu again, this is a neat email, because it is a little bit of a snapshot of the past. First of all, how cool is it to have the box set of your very first install, your very first Linux install? I think in a way, maybe, probably not, to be honest. Who am I kidding? I was going to say, maybe if I'd understood what a thing Linux was going to become for me, I would have kept my first install disk. And as I've said before, the very first Linux install I did was of Mandriva. I think it was 2007 or 2008 disk. And I say that because Mandriva was a combination of something and Mandrake. So Mandriva was this sort of the second iteration of Mandrake Linux, second iteration of that, if we consider, for instance, Magia, the third iteration, which I do. So Mandriva, they used to number their releases, I believe, for, you know, sort of like the year ahead, which used to confuse, I think, a lot of people until you kind of think about it from the marketplace perspective, like the literal market, because things on shelves, they won't carry those things if they're dated last year. I mean, they will. I'm sure places sold Windows 95 well into 97 or whatever, but traditionally, places do not like to keep things that are backdated on their shelves. So if you're releasing a thing, you usually want to date it forward so that it is good for that year. So it makes sense. But anyway, it's confusing if you think about what year did you do that in. I think it was the 2007 one, but from screenshots online, it also kind of looks like 2008, but maybe it just didn't change that much. Either it was the one with the Matisse window manager options on it anyway. So, and I don't know if that's the only one, but it did have that as an option. So that was the technical first one that I installed. And I got it out of the back of a book about Linux because I was researching the subject and it came with a little CD in the back. And so I put it onto a friend's computer just to see, I literally could not believe it was possible. I just thought, this seems crazy. I'm going to boot off of this CD and have an OS. Apparently, I don't think it'll work, but I guess I'll try it. And it literally felt like a scam. It felt too good to be true. It felt like a fantasy. Because I used to wonder about how would it be to have an OS that wasn't Mac or Windows. You know, I used to wonder about that as a person, and I had no concept of how that would be possible. I never thought about the fact that when you booted up a PlayStation or a Nintendo or something, that you were experiencing an operating system. That never occurred to me. That's the same thing. Computers were never quite presented to me without the paradigm of it's Mac versus Windows. And there was never any consideration that that both of those were implementations of a way of running a computer. And the note about the floppy disk problem is, again, just such a snapshot of its time, and I think it kind of reinforces that and just what I've just said about not understanding what an operating system is. It just kind of reinforces that I was not, at that time, ready for Linux. So as much as I kind of, you know, there is a tinge of regret here and there, thinking, oh man, wouldn't it have been cool to have gotten into Linux sooner? I could have had so much more time with it and so much more reference and context and experience and knowledge. But as with so many things in life, I think it just kind of happened, for me at least, when it needed to happen. And I respect greatly the people for whom Linux was a possible reality for them back in 1995. That's just so cool. Now, I do have in my possession, I stole these from my father. He was getting into Linux around that same time. And I have two CDs here from, it looks like 1998 is one, 1999 is the other. One is a four-disc set from a company called Infomagic. And it has Red Hat 5.0 with kernel 2.0.32, SUS 5.1 with kernel 2.0.33, Slackware 3.4 with kernel 2.0.30, and what else? Anything else? Other stuff like Metro X. I don't even know what that is. X-Free 86. Red Hat's Power Tools 5.0 with sources. Kernel sources from 2.0.33 and 2.1.79. So two kernel sources on here. Linux archives from tsx-11.mit.edu and SunSite. prep.unc.edu, GNU Archive from prep.ai.mit.edu, Apache www for Linux version 1.2.5, LessTiff for Linux 0.8, and a complete online docs and how-tos installation guide and networking guide. That's the four-disc set from Infomagic. There's another one I have here from Walnut Creek, and Walnut Creek is rather, at least in my world, famous for being, as far as I understand, the one of the original distributor, or the original distributor, as I understand it. It could have been, maybe it's a different one, but Walnut Creek, as I understand it, is the original distributor of Slackware. So that's really cool. And this is a Red Hat 6.0 CD, and it's got a little advertisement in the liner note section in the little pamphlet for FreeBSD, a full 4.4 BSD Lite-based 32-bit operating system from Berkeley, BSD Unix. FreeBSD Toolkit, a robust collection of binary snapshots, packages, dist files, documentation, and distribution source. Six-disc set. Wow, that's a big set. And it's got a bunch of other stuff too, like the complete FreeBSD reference, Slackware Linux, the official Slackware Linux, Internet's favorite, full PC Unix, four disks, Linux Toolkit, a six-disc set, business apps for Linux, Linux Games++, X11R6.3, GNU Sources, Toolkit for Solaris, C Users Group Library, Source Code 1 to 3 for Usenet Source Code from the experts, Perl, Tex, T-E-X, like latex, that's a two-disc set, and Toolkit for Delphi. I've heard of Delphi vaguely, but I don't know what it is. Anyway, those are the archives that I have, and neither of them are actually things that I used at the time. They are things that someone I know used at the time, but I did not. I tried to install some of that on hardware once, and it went well up until the point that you needed a USB stack, at which point it fell over. But many of them, or all of them, worked quite well in a virtual machine, so that was a lot of fun for a week or weekend. I also got an email from Herog. You may remember him from episode 397. I interviewed him about a book podcast that he was working on. He says that he wasn't familiar with Kontakt, and honestly had never opened Kontakt because I simply assumed it was just the application for managing contacts, and all the contacts I have, I keep in my own memory. With that said, your latest episode, 444, really got me thinking. I don't honestly have a lot of RSS Atom feeds that I follow, and I would like to change that. I think I sort of got fed up with all the feeds being shortened versions of articles. It's a good point. A lot of RSS feeds lately have kind of started to default to click more, you know, click here to read more. I don't actually mind that so much. I mean, I kind of do, because when I'm looking at my RSS feed reader, one of the things about that is that I'm in my RSS feed reader, and I don't necessarily want to have to navigate somewhere else. It's just, you know, it makes the completeness of that RSS feed feel a lot less complete. So that is kind of annoying, but in practice, I don't think I really notice that much. I think largely because of Aggregator. Aggregator makes it pretty transparent, and so I think for that reason it doesn't bother me that much. I treat RSS feeds, well, I guess like Linux install disks. I generally treat them as very sort of ephemeral. I go to my RSS feed reader, I look to see if there are any interesting articles lately, and if there are, I read them, and then I kind of forget about them, and that's the extent of it. It was by chance that that Aggregator itself happens to have archived, it keeps an archive of the feed, more or less whether I want it to or not. I mean, that's wrong, actually. I can tell it to delete articles, and it will forget those articles exist. So I could do that. In practice, I do not. And so typically I end up accidentally having an archive of a bunch of stuff, but it is not something that I do intentionally. As I've already established, I'm not very good at keeping track of historical artifacts. I'm really, really bad at that, actually. If I were better, I would have Linux install disks from when I first installed Linux, or ones that were particularly important to me. But I moved around a lot for a long time, so it just wasn't pragmatic for me to keep track of stuff. And And even I feel like I've been in New Zealand for something like 8 or 9 years now, so even now I don't tend to hold on to stuff if I can help it. It's just if it's not something that I use, I tend to try to pass it on. So RSS feeds, it does tend to collect stuff whether I intend for it to do that or not, unless I consciously, remove things. But Herag, the question ultimately was, what do I follow in the RSS feed reader? And it's kind of an interesting question, but it's kind of also it's difficult to answer. I mean, it's easy to answer. It's difficult to determine whether an answer is useful, because I follow, well, certainly the default three RSS entries that come with aggregator, which is kind of funny because if you're like me, and I think most people in this case, I think a lot of us share this trait, the default thing in an application, that's the first thing you get rid of. Like, you understand, okay, it's there because it's gotta be there to demonstrate that the application works, or for branding purposes, or whatever. So you get rid of all those things so you can put your own stuff into the application. But actually, for once, with aggregator, I'm actually quite happy with the default, the demo settings. Those are really, really nice little things to follow. KDE.news, Planet KDE, and Planet KDE PIM. The latter one sounds very specific, but it actually is. There's a lot of variety on all of those. You'll get news about KDE and Qt and Plasma and PIM, and specifically KDE PIM, and just all kinds of things. So it's not as specific as it sounds to say that it's Planet KDE PIM, just because a lot of the people posting in one place are also involved in other areas, so you do get a variety. So in terms of technical stuff, the other stuff that I add, first of all, I guess would be the CVE database. Every time a vulnerability is added to the CVE, it gets posted to this RSS feed. Or I think there are a couple of different RSS feeds. I just grabbed, I think this is kind of the big all-inclusive one, I think. It's just as much, as many open reports as there are in the CVE. That's what I want to see. And really, it's one of those things where I just scan through the headlines, or I don't know if it's called the headline, but whatever the entry when you see it on the RSS in the list, I scan through that list just to see if there's something that I recognize, or something that's kind of confusing or interesting. And then when you click on an article, you do have to click to get through to the actual like listing. So I really just use it sort of, yeah, as an index, essentially. And that works out fine. I don't think I would want to leisurely read through all of these at any point, but it is good to just kind of keep an eye on what's going on, I guess. That's just kind of how I do it. Not very precise, but it's just my methodology. So that's the CVE thing. If you're really, really into Emacs, you probably already know Sasha Chua. If you're only really into Emacs, just one really, not two reallys, then you might not know her. And if you don't, and you are into Emacs, you should subscribe to Sasha Chua. She's just a person on the internet, really, who happened to stumble on Emacs at one point and got really, really into it. That's from what I recall of sort of when I first discovered her. That was her story, and now she writes about Emacs, and she writes about how she uses Emacs in her everyday life, and she manages or coordinates a Emacs conference. So it's a great place to just kind of get it. It's a nice central location for a lot of Emacs activity. That's Sasha Chua. Again, I'll put all these links in the show notes, I guess. And then finally, there's, or maybe not finally, but also, well, here's one. Here's GB Hackers. I don't even know what that stands for. Great Britain Hackers. GB Hackers is a thing that I found online when I was just, I don't know how I found it, gbhackers.com. But they had some good articles, and it's worth a subscription. I mean, it's free to subscribe. And those articles actually come into, oh no, they don't. Look at that. See how transparent it is. Like, in my head, all of these articles were actually here, but But actually what's happening is that I click on go to the complete story, and then it pops up in aggregator. So you know, it's hard sometimes to realize that you're not still in aggregator, that you're actually, I mean, you realize it, but it's in my memory, you know, I don't think of it as, well, I didn't go to a browser, but obviously a browser came to me in an aggregator tab. It's nice. It's quite nice. So anyway, that was GB Hackers. And then there's Julia Evans, who does a really, really good job, jvns.ca. She does a really, really good job of explaining some pretty advanced technical topics through, a lot of times, through little web comics. It's a lot of fun. But she also also writes about a bunch of other stuff, and about technology and Linux and zines, and just a really diverse kind of creative take on technology, but not with a focus on creativity. It's just a creative take on technology. It's pretty neat. And then there are some tabletop gaming stuff that I follow, but I'm not going to go over that here in the technology show. So I will post the links to those in the show notes. If you are looking for RSS feeds, I'm not guaranteeing that they will satisfy your technical curiosity or provide you with anything other than links to content on the internet, which I know that you can find probably on your own as well. But since Harag asked, I have answered. But I think now we're out of time. This is the end of the show. We've reached it. Come back for more next time. I'll talk to you then.